Speaking of mice, Whitbread said. How can they live on a steel ship? Sally asked. Whitbread shrugged. They come aboard with the food supplies, even in personal gear. Once in a while we evacuate portions of the ship, move the crew around, and open up to space to control them. But we never get them all. This trip, with all the extra personnel aboard, we haven't even been able to do that.
Interesting, Sally nodded.
Mice can live almost anywhere humans can. You know, there are probably as many mice in the galaxy as people. We've carried them to nearly every planet.
Jonathan, are the miniatures mice?
Whitbread shrugged.
She certainly didn't care about them. Killed all but two.
But why bring two aboard? And a randomly selected two at that.
Sally nodded again.
We watched her catch them.
She laughed suddenly. And Mr. Renner was wondering if they were baby motis. Get to sleep, Jonathan. We'll see you in 10 hours or so.
17. Mr. Crawford's eviction. Midshipman Jonathan Whitbread reached his hammock much sooner than he had expected. He sagged blissfully into the netting and closed his eyes, and opened one, feeling other eyes upon him.
"Yes, Mr. Potter," he sighed.
"Mr. Whitbread, I would be obliged if you would talk to Mr. Staley."
It was not what he expected. Whitbread opened his other eye.
"Huh? Something's upset him. You know how he is. He won't complain. He'd rather die. But he walks around like a robot. Hardly speaks to anyone except politely. He eats alone. You've known him longer than I have. I thought you might find out why."
"All right, Potter, I'll try. When I wake up."
He closed his eyes. Potter was still there.
"In 8 hours, Potter. It can't be that urgent."
In another part of MacArthur, Sailing Master Renner tossed fitfully in a stateroom not much larger than his bunk. It was the third lieutenant's berth, but two scientists had Renner's cabin, and the third had moved in with a marine officer. Renner sat up suddenly in the darkness, his mind hunting for something that might have been a dream. Then he turned on the light and fumbled with the unfamiliar intercom panel. The rating who answered showed remarkable self-control. He didn't scream or anything.
"Get me Miss Sally Fowler," Renner said.
The rating did, without comment.
Must be a robot, Renner thought.
He knew how he looked. Sally was not asleep. She and Dr. Horvath had just finished installing the moti in the gunnery officer's cabin. Her face and voice as she said,
"Yes, Mr. Renner,"
somehow informed Renner that he looked like a cross between a man and a mole, a remarkable feat of nonverbal communication. Renner skipped it.
"I remembered something. Have you got your pocket computer?"
"Certainly."
She took it out to show him. "Please test it for me." Her face, a puzzled mask, Sally drew letters on the face of the flat box, wiped them, scrawled a simple problem, then a complex one that would require the ship's computer to help. Then she called up an arbitrary personal data file from ship's memory.
"It works all right."
Renner's voice was thick with sleep.
"Am I crazy, or did we watch the moti take that thing apart and put it back together again?"
"Certainly. She did the same with your gun."
"But a pocket computer?"
Renner stared. "You know that's impossible, don't you?" She thought it was a joke.
"No, I didn't."
"Well, it is. Ask Dr. Horvath." Renner hung up and went back to sleep. Sally caught up with Dr. Horvath as he was turning into his cabin. She told him about the computer.
"But those things are one big integrated circuit. We don't even try to repair them,"
Horvath muttered other things to himself. While Renner slept, Horvath and Sally woke the physical sciences staff. None of them got much sleep that night. Morning on a warship is a relative thing. The morning watch is from 0400 to 0800 hours, a time when the human species would normally sleep. But space knows nothing of this. A full crew is needed on the bridge and in the engine rooms, no matter what the time. As a watchkeeping officer, Whitbread stood one watch in three. But MacArthur's orderly quarterbill was confused beyond repair.
He had both the morning and forenoon watches off. 8 glorious hours of sleep. Yet somehow, he found himself awake and in the warrant officer's mess at 0900.
"There's nothing wrong with me," Horst Staley protested.
"I don't know where you get that idea. Forget it."
"Okay,"
Whitbread said easily. He chose juice and cereal and put them on his tray. He was just behind Staley in the cafeteria line, which was natural enough since he had followed Staley in.
"Though I appreciate your concern," Staley told him.
There was no trace of emotion in the voice. Whitbread nodded agreeably. He picked up his tray and followed Staley's unnaturally straight back. Predictably, Staley chose an empty table. Whitbread joined him. In the Empire were numerous worlds where the dominant races were white Caucasian. On such worlds, the pictures on Navy enlistment posters always looked like Horst Staley. His jaw was square, his eyes icy blue. His face was all planes and angles, bilaterally symmetrical, and without expression. His back was straight, his shoulders broad. His belly was flat and hard and ridged with muscle. He contrasted sharply with Whitbread, who would fight a weight problem all his life, and was at least slightly rounded everywhere. They ate in silence, a long breakfast. Finally, too casually, Staley asked, as if he had to ask, "How went your mission?" Whitbread was ready.
"Rugged. The worst hour and a half the Moti spent staring at me. Look!"
Whitbread stood. He twisted his head sideways and let his knees sag and shoulders slump to fit him into an invisible coffin 130 centimeters high.
"Like this, for an hour and a half."
He sat down again. "Torture, I tell you. I kept wishing they'd picked you." Staley flushed.
"I did volunteer."
"Bullseye.
It was my turn. You were the one who accepted Defiant's surrender back off New Chicago. And let that maniac steal my bomb?"
Whitbread put his fork down.
"Oh? You didn't know?
Of course not.
Think Blaine would spread it all over the ship?
You did come back a bit shaken after that mission. We wondered why. Now you know. Some jackass tried to renege. Defiant's captain wouldn't let him, but he might have."
Staley rubbed his hands together painfully hard.
"He snatched the bomb away from me. And I let him. I'd have given anything for the chance to—"
Staley stood up suddenly. But Whitbread was quick enough to catch him by the arm.
"Sit down," he said. "I can tell you why you weren't picked.
I suppose you can read the captain's mind?"
They kept their voices low by tacit consent. MacArthur's interior partitions were all sound-absorbent anyway, and their voices were very clear, if soft.
"Second-guessing officers is good practice for a middy," said Whitbread.
"Why, then? Was it because of the bomb?"
"Indirectly. You'd have been tempted to prove yourself. But even without that, you're too much the hero, Horst. Perfect physical shape, good lungs. Ever meet an admiral with a soft voice? Utter dedication, and no sense of humor."
"I do, too, have a sense of humor."
"No, you don't."
"I don't?"
"Not a trace. The situation didn't call for a hero, Horst. It called for someone who didn't mind being made ridiculous in a good cause."
"You're kidding." "Damn, I never know when you're kidding."
"Now would be a poor time. I'm not making fun of you, Horst. Listen, I shouldn't have to explain this. You watched it all, didn't you?"
"Sally told me I was on all the intercom screens, live, in color, and 3D.
"You were." Staley smiled briefly.
"We should have had a view of your face, especially when you started swearing. We got no warning at all. The view jumped a bit, then you screamed at the alien, and everybody cracked up.
What would you have done?"
"Not that. I don't know. Followed orders, I guess."
The icy eyes narrowed.
"I wouldn't have tried to shoot my way out, if that's what you're thinking."
"Maybe a second of cutting laser into the control panel? To kill the force field?"
"Not without orders."
"What about the sign language? I spent some time making gestures, hoping the alien would understand me, but it never did."
"We couldn't see that.
What about it?"
"I told you," Whitbread said.
The mission took someone willing to make a fool of himself in a good cause. Think about how often you heard people laugh at me while I was bringing back the Moti. Staley nodded. Now forget them, and think about the Moti. What about her sense of humor? Would you like a Moti laughing at you, Horst? You might never be sure if she was or wasn't. You don't know what it looks like or sounds like.
You're being ridiculous.
All anyone knew was that the situation called for someone to find out whether the aliens were willing to talk to us. It didn't need someone to uphold the Imperial honor. Plenty of time for that after we know what we're facing. There'll be room for heroes, Horst. There always is.
That's reassuring, said Staley.
He had finished breakfast. Now he stood and walked out fast, with his back very straight, leaving Whitbread wondering.
Oh, well, Whitbread thought. I tried, and just maybe...
Luxury in a warship is relative. Gunnery Officer Crawford's stateroom was the size of his bed. When the bed was up, he had room to change clothes and a small sink to brush his teeth. To lower the bed for sleeping, he had first to step into the corridor, and, being tall for a Navy man, Crawford had learned to sleep curled up. A bed and a door with a lock on it, instead of a hammock or one tier of many bunks. Luxury. He would have fought to keep it, but he had lost the toss. Now he bunked in MacArthur's cutter, while an alien monster occupied his quarters.
She's only a little more than a meter tall, of course she fits, Sally Fowler said judiciously. Still, it's only a tiny room. Do you think she can stand it? Otherwise, we'll have to keep her in the lounge.
I saw the cabin of her ship. It wasn't any bigger.
She can stand it, Whitbread said.
It was too late to try sleeping in the gun room, and he was supposed to tell the scientists everything he knew. At least that ought to work if Cargill asked why he'd been pestering Sally.
I suppose you've got someone watching her through the intercom?
She nodded. Whitbread followed her into the scientist's lounge. Part of the room had been screened off with wire netting, and the two miniatures were in there. One was nibbling at a head of cabbage, using four arms to hold it to her chest. The other, her abdomen swollen with pregnancy, was playing with a flashlight.
Just like a monkey, Whitbread thought.
It was the first chance he'd had to look at the miniatures. Their fur was thicker and mottled brown and yellow, where the large one was uniformly soft brown. The forearms were nearly alike, five fingers on the left hands and six on the rights. But the arms and fingers were identically slender, identically jointed. Yet the muscles of the upper left shoulder were anchored to the top of the skull. Why, if not for greater strength and leverage? He was delighted when Sally led him to a small corner table away from where the biosciences people were scratching their heads and arguing loudly. He got coffee for both of them and asked her about the strange musculature of the miniatures. It wasn't what he'd really like to talk to her about, but it was a start.
"We think it's vestigial," she said. "They obviously don't need it. The left arms aren't sized for heavy work anyway."
"Then the little ones aren't monkeys. They're an offshoot of the big ones."
"Or they're both an offshoot of something else. Jonathan, we've got more than two classifications already. Look."
She turned to the intercom screen, and a view of the Moti's room appeared.
"She seems happy enough," said Whitbread.
He grinned at what the Moti had been doing.
"Mr. Crawford isn't going to like what she's done to his bunk."
"Dr. Horvath didn't want to stop her. She can fiddle with anything she likes as long as it isn't the intercom."
Crawford's bunk had been shortened and contoured. The contours were exceedingly strange, not only because of the complex joints in the Moti's back, but also because she apparently slept on her side. The mattress had been cut and sewn, the underlying steel bent and twisted. Now there were grooves for two right arms and a pit for a projecting hip bone and a high ridge to serve as a pillow.
"Why would she sleep only on her right side?" Whitbread asked.
"Maybe she'd rather defend herself with her left if she happened to be surprised in her sleep. The left is so much stronger."
"Could be. Poor Crawford.
Maybe she's expecting him to try and cut her throat some night."
He watched the alien at work on the overhead lamp.
She does have a one-track mind, doesn't she? We could get some good out of this. She might improve something.
Perhaps. Jonathan, did you study sketches of the dissected alien?
She sounded like a schoolmistress. She was old enough to be one, too, but much too pretty, Whitbread thought. He said,
Yes, ma'am. Do you see any differences?
The color of the fur is different, but that's nothing. The other one was in suspended animation for hundreds of years.
Anything else?
The other one was taller, I think. I wouldn't swear.
Look at her head.
Whitbread frowned. I don't see it. Sally used her pocket computer. It hummed slightly, indicating that it was in communication with the main ship's memory. Somewhere in MacArthur, a laser moved across holographic lines. The ship's memory held everything humanity knew of Motis, such as it was. It found the information Sally asked for and sent it to her pocket computer. A sketch appeared on the face of the flat box. Whitbread studied the sketch, then looked to the screen and the Moti.
Her forehead. It slopes. That's what we thought, Dr. Horvath and I.
It's not easy to see. The Moti's head is so flinking lopsided anyway.
I know, but it's there. We think there's a difference in the hands, too, but it's very small.
Sally frowned, and three short grooves appeared between brown eyes. She'd cut her hair short for space, and the frown and short hair made her look very efficient. Whitbread didn't like it.
That gives us three different kinds of Moti, she said, and only four Motis. That's a high mutation rate, wouldn't you say?
I wouldn't be surprised. Whitbread remembered the history lessons Chaplain Hardy had held for the midshipmen during the trip out. They're trapped in this system, bottled up. If they had an atomic war, they'd have to live with it afterwards, wouldn't they? He thought of Earth and shuddered.
We haven't seen any evidence of atomic wars.
Except the mutation rate. Sally laughed.
You're arguing in circles. Anyway, it doesn't hold up. None of these three types is a cripple, Jonathan. They're all very well adapted, all healthy, except the dead one, of course, and she hardly counts. They wouldn't choose a cripple to pilot the probe.
No.
So, what's the answer? You saw them first, Jonathan. Call the one in the probe type A. What was the relationship between types B and C?
I don't know.
But you saw them together.
It didn't make sense. The little ones stayed out of the big one's way at first, and the big one let them alone. Then I signaled the big one that I wanted her to go with me to MacArthur. She forthwith picked the first two little ones that came to hand, made sure they were safe, and killed the rest without warning.
Whitbread paused, thinking of the whirlwind that had blown him out the Moti ship airlock.
So you tell me, what are the little ones? Pets? Children?
But she killed them.
Vermin? Why save two of them? Food animals? Have you tried that?
Sally grimaced. It was almost a snarl, remarkable on her pretty face, an expression she would never have worn on any social occasion.
Tried what? Fricassee one of the little beasts and offer it to the big one? Be reasonable.
The alien in Crawford's room poured a handful of some kind of seed and ate it.
Popcorn, said Sally.
We tried it on the little ones first. Maybe that's what they were for. Food testers.
Maybe.
She eats cabbage, too.
Well, she won't starve. But she may die of vitamin deficiencies.
All we can do is watch and wait.
I suppose we'll go to the alien's home planet pretty soon. In the meantime, Jonathan, you're the only man who's seen the Moti ship. Was the pilot's seat contoured? I only got a glimpse of it through your helmet camera.
It was contoured. In fact, it fitted her like a glove.
I noticed something else.
The control board ran along the right side of the seat, for right hands only.
He remembered a great deal about the mining ship, as it turned out. It kept him in Lady Sally's enjoyable company until he had to go on watch. But none of it was particularly useful.
Whitbread had no sooner taken his station on the bridge than Dr. Buckman called for the captain.
A ship, Blaine, Buckman said.
From the inhabitable world, Moat Prime. We didn't find it because it was hidden by that damned laser signal. Blaine nodded. His own screens had shown the Moti ship 9 minutes before. Chief Shattuck's crew wasn't about to let civilians keep a better watch than the Navy.
"It will reach us in about 81 hours, Buckman said. "It's accelerating at 0.87 Gs, which is the surface gravity of Moat Prime by some odd coincidence. It's spitting neutrinos. In general, it behaves like the first ship, except that it's far more massive. I'll let you know if we get anything else."
"Fine. Keep an eye on it, Doctor." Blaine nodded, and Whitbread cut the circuit. The captain turned to his exec. "Let's compare what we know with Buckman's file, number one."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Cargill toyed with the computer controls for a few minutes.
"Captain?"
"Yes."
"Look at the starting time. That alien ship got underway in not much more than an hour after we broke out."
Blaine whistled to himself.
"Are you sure? That gives 10 minutes to detect us, another 10 for us to D them, and 40 minutes to get ready and launch.
Jack, what kind of ship launches in 40 minutes?
Cargill frowned. "None I ever heard of. The Navy could do it. Keep a ship with a full crew on ready alert."
"Precisely. I think that's a warship coming at us, number one.
You'd better tell the Admiral, then Horvath."
"Whitbread, get me Buckman."
"Yes?"
The astrophysicist looked harried.
"Doctor, I need everything your people can get about that Moti ship, now. And would you give some thought to their rather strange acceleration?"
Buckman studied the numbers Blaine sent down to his screen.
"This seems straightforward enough. They launched from Moat Prime, or a closely orbiting moon, 40 minutes after we arrived. What's the problem?"
"If they launched that fast, it's almost certainly a warship. We'd like to believe otherwise."
Buckman was annoyed.
"Believe what you like, but you'll ruin the math, Captain. Either they launched in 40 minutes, or... well, you could start the Moti vehicle something over 2 million kilometers this side of Moat Prime. That would give them more time, but I don't believe it."
"No more do I.
I want you to satisfy yourself about this, Dr. Buckman. What could we assume that would give them more time to launch?"
"Let me see. I'm not used to thinking in terms of rocketry, you know. Gravitational accelerations are more my field, if you'll pardon the pun."
Buckman's eyes went curiously blank. For a moment, he looked like an idiot.
"You'd have to assume a period of coasting and a much higher acceleration in the launching mechanism. Much higher."
"How long to coast?"
"Several hours, for every hour you want to give them to make up their minds. Captain, I don't understand your problem. Why can't they have launched a scientific survey ship in 40 minutes? Why assume a warship? After all, MacArthur is both, and it took you an unreasonably long time to launch. I was ready days early."
Blaine turned him off.
"I'll break his scrawny neck," he told himself. "They'll court-martial me, but I'll claim justifiable homicide. I'll subpoena everyone who knew him. They're bound to let me off."
He touched keys.
"Number one, what have you got?"
"They launched that ship in 40 minutes.
"Which makes it a warship."
"So the Admiral thinks, sir. Dr. Horvath wasn't convinced."
"Neither am I, but we'll want to be ready for them.
And we'll want to know more about Motis than Horvath's people are learning from our passenger. Number one, I want you to take the cutter and get over to that asteroid the Moti came from. There's no sign of activity there, so it should be safe enough. And I want to know just what the Moti was doing there. It might give us a clue."
18. The Stone Beehive. Horace Berry watched the foot-high Motis playing behind the wire screen.
"Do they bite?" he asked.
"They haven't yet," Horvath answered. "Not even when the biotechs took blood samples."
Berry puzzled him.
Science Minister Horvath considered himself a good judge of people. Once he'd left science and gone into politics, he'd had to learn fast. But he couldn't fathom Barry's thought processes. The trader's easy smile was only a public face. Behind it,
Remote and emotionless, he watched the Motis, like God judging a dubious creation. Barry was thinking, my, but they're ugly. What a shame. They'd be useless as house pets unless... He checked himself and stepped forward to reach through a gap in the netting large enough for an arm but not a Moti. Behind the ear, Horvath suggested. Thank you. Barry wondered if one would come to investigate his hand. The thin one came, and Barry scratched her behind the ear. Carefully, for the ear looked fragile and delicate. But she seemed to enjoy it. They'd make terrible pets, Barry thought. But they'd sell for thousands each. For a while, before the novelty wore off, best to hit every planet simultaneously. If they breed in captivity, and if we can keep them fed, and if I sell out before people stop buying...
Alibi! She took my watch!
They love tools. You may have noticed that flashlight we gave them.
Never mind that, Horvath. How do I get my watch back? In Allah's...
How did the catch come unfastened? Reach in and take it. Or let me. Horvath tried. The enclosure was too big, and the Moti didn't want to give up the watch. Horvath dithered. I don't want to disturb them too much. Horvath, that watch is worth 800 crowns. It not only tells the time and the date, but... Barry paused. Come to that, it's also shockproof. We advertise that any shock that will stop a Kronos will also kill the owner. She probably can't hurt it much. The Moti was examining the wristwatch in a sober, studious manner. Barry wondered if others would find that manner captivating. No house pet behaved like that. Not even cats. You have cameras on them? Of course, said Horvath. My firm may want to buy this sequence. For advertising purposes. That's one thing, Barry thought. Now there was a Moti ship coming here and Cargill taking the cutter somewhere. He'd never get anywhere pumping Cargill. But Buckman was going. There might be returns from the coffee the astrophysicist drank after all. The thought saddened him obscurely. The cutter was the largest of the vehicles in hangar deck. She was a lifting body, with a flat upper surface that fitted flat against one wall of hangar deck. She had her own access hatches, to join the cutter's airlocks to the habitable regions of MacArthur, because hangar deck was usually in vacuum. There was no Langston Field generator aboard the cutter, and no Alderson drive. But her drive was efficient and powerful, and her fuel capacity was considerable, even without strap-on tanks. The ablative shielding along her nose was good for one re-entry into a terrestrial atmosphere at up to 20 kilometers per second, or many re-entries if they could be taken more slowly. She was designed for a crew of 6, but would carry more. She could go from planet to planet, but not between stars. History had been made again and again by spacecraft smaller than MacArthur's cutter. There were half a dozen men bunking in her now. One had been kicked out to make room for Crawford when Crawford was kicked out of his own stateroom by a 3-armed alien. Cargill smiled when he saw that. I'll take Crawford, he decided. Be ashamed to move him again. Lafferty is coxswain. 3 Marines. He bent over his crew list. Staley is midshipman. He'd welcome a chance to prove himself, and was steady enough under orders. The cutter's interior was clean and polished, but there was evidence of Sinclair's oddball repairs along the port wall, where Defiance lasers had flashed through the ablative shielding. Even at the long distances from which the cutter engaged, the damage had been severe. Cargill spread his things out in the only enclosed cabin space and reviewed his flight plan options. Over that distance, they could go at 3 Gs all the way. In practice, it might be 1 G over and 5 back. Just because the rock didn't have a fusion plant didn't mean it was uninhabited. Jack Cargill remembered the speed with which the Moti had rebuilt his big percolator, without even knowing what coffee was supposed to taste like. Could they be beyond fusion? He left his gear and put on a pressure suit, a skin-tight woven garment that was just porous enough to allow sweat to pass. It was a self-regulating temperature control,
and with the tightly woven fabric to assist, his own skin was able to stand up to space. The helmet attached to a seal at the collar. In combat, heavy armor would go over the whole mess, but this was good enough for inspections.